The stage is set. Get a front row seat in the run-up to the election by subscribing to The Spectator for just £3 for 3 months. We'll even send you a free election mug. Go to spectator.co.uk/mug.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, Natasha Farrows looks at one of the underreported angles of this general election, the potential return of ex-Labour MP Keith Vaz. Robert Addis warns against studying sociology A-level. Reviewing Catherine Bucknell's book, Christopher Isherwood, Inside Out, Lucaster Miller says Isherwood's experiences in Weimar Germany would haunt him for the rest of his life. Sam McPhail provides his notes on Madry, the lager conquering British pubs, and Toby Young explains his decision to vote Reform. Finally, in our Guest Life column this week, Catriona Olding, widow of the much-loved Spectator lowlife columnist Jeremy Clark, reflects on love, family and friendship. Up first, Natasha Farrows.
When Keith Vaz announced his ambition to stand as independent for Leicester East, no one in my hometown was surprised. Vaz may be a joke nationally, known for his cocaine use and a fondness for rent boys, but in Leicester East, he remains something of a local hero. It may seem astonishing to the rest of the country, but it's quite possible that despite everything, come July, Vaz will make a triumphant return. Leicester was one of the first British cities to have a majority non-white population, and its British Indians are a highly prized voting bloc. They are the country's largest immigrant group, young, fast-growing, and aspirational. For decades, Vaz represented this group's connection to the Labour Party, and when he stood down from the Commons in 2019, there was a drift of Hindus and Muslims away from their left-leaning political roots. Jeremy Corbyn didn't help. His vocal support for Kashmir's independence saw many Hindus fall out of love with Labour, and now the Gaza effect also threatens to chip away at the party's Muslim support. It is these issues that the seven candidates in Leicester East are being forced to address when knocking on doors. Vaz is standing for the One Leicester Party, and he'll be going head-to-head with his successor, the current MP Claudia Webb. Webb, like Vaz, is an independent who has a past scandal to contend with. In 2020, she was expelled from the Labour Party after she was given a suspended sentence for harassing her ex-boyfriend's partner. She is vying with Vaz for the Muslim vote and is reportedly in talks with George Galloway's pro-Palestine party. Meanwhile, Labour has made the mistake once again of picking a non-local candidate, Rajesh Agrawal, a former deputy mayor of London. Labour's failings mean that for the first time in decades, the Conservatives have started being taken seriously as contenders. A council by-election within the constituency in 2022 resulted in a huge swing to the Tories, who won, with Labour relegated to third place. The local Conservative Party also welcomed defectors when Labour's National Committee dramatically purged 19 of its councillors before the 2023 local elections. Rishi Sunak, as the first Hindu Prime Minister, was also very appealing to Leicester East, but Vaz could topple everything. It helps that he knows every corner of the city and visits them regularly. "He was here just 2 days ago," says an elderly woman I speak to on the High Street flower shop. She lights up at the mention of his name. "He wanted to take my picture." Vaz's scandals are also lower down on the list of people's priorities these days, especially after the violent conflicts between Hindus and Muslims in 2022. "As long as their family's immigration papers are sorted, they don't care," one constituent tells me. Vaz's biggest endorsement came a few years ago when he was voted honorary chair of Leicester East Labour Party, a contentious decision made by the local members as he had been blacklisted by Labour Party HQ. But while Vaz may have faced national disgrace, the local party understood how important he was perceived in the area and how resilient he is. The man is, after all, known as Mr. Vaseline. Problems that would have destroyed other people seem to slide off him. First elected to the Commons in 1987, by 2012 he had already faced two parliamentary investigations, been forced out as Europe Minister, been suspended from Parliament for a month, and faced accusations over his expenses. Yet he went on. In 2016, a Sunday Mirror sting operation uncovered him offering to buy cocaine for male prostitutes. He resigned as the Home Affairs Select Committee, stating, "Those who hold others to account must themselves be held to account." Yet within a month, as the investigation into the scandal was underway, he applied to join the Justice Select Committee, and the bid was successful. Following the end of the investigation in 2019, he was suspended from the Commons for 6 months, but not long into his suspension period, resigned from Parliament. He came under further scrutiny in 2021 when a report revealed that as an MP, he had engaged in sustained and unpleasant bullying towards parliamentary staff. Vaz declined to cooperate with this report, claiming to be too ill. Only John Bercow, with his own history of bullying allegations, defended him. Vaz's CV then is far from ideal, yet the voters in Leicester seem to be able to overlook his faults. Better the devil you know than the devil you don't, one resident told me. He has an army of volunteers built up over decades who remain his loyal supporters. Compared to the other six candidates, he is easily the most experienced canvasser. The relationship between Vaz and the South Asian community can be hard for outsiders to understand. South Asians are often known for their socially conservative values, so you'd have thought they'd be put off by a sex scandal. Yet Vaz has put in the work. He offered himself up as a local commentator when out of office, running his own radio show, with Bollywood stars like Shilpa Shetty dialing in. He was rumoured to continue weekly surgeries despite no longer being an MP. When the Leicester riots kicked off in 2022, he posted a video describing the city as one big happy family, defending its reputation. Leicester is often name-checked by politicians such as Suella Braverman, who want to prove that multiculturalism has failed in Britain. But here, those riots were not viewed through the lens of a Hindu-Muslim divide. Rather, people think that the violence broke out because of a tension between the older and newer immigrants. The rioters were made up largely of a new migrant community called Daman and Diu, next to Gujarat, which were colonised by Portugal. These migrants have settled in Britain under Portuguese citizenship. There are now nearly 20,000 Portuguese passport holders in Leicester, making up 5% of the population. Their conditions are poor, they work in textiles warehouses and often have many families living under one roof. It is a growing issue for local residents, one that Leicester's next MP will be forced to address, not least because whoever is elected can't win by appealing to one voter bloc alone. But if Leicester's melting pot demographics work in anyone's favour, it's Vaz's. As a Christian whose family is from Goa, he can lean in and out of identity politics in a way that makes him seem relatable to a variety of groups. And if he does, he may very well become the next MP for Leicester East once again.
That was Natasha Farrows. Next, Robert Addis.
Women are more religious because they are socialised to be obedient and passive. In Latin America, men often spend 20 to 40% of the household income on alcohol, as well as further spending on tobacco, gambling, and prostitutes. The Challenger space shuttle disaster in 1986 is an example of a state-initiated corporate crime. All examples taken verbatim from the Most Common Sociology A-Level Coursebook by Napier Press, and used by students for the AQA syllabus, the most commonly used exam board. They lack any qualifying language or citation and are presented as fact. Sociology as a school subject is a soup of half-baked old left apologist propaganda, daft pub conspiracy theories, self-defeating second-wave feminist rants, and an actively denied undercurrent of Western Christian superiority. More terrifying still are the generalisations about science. Quote, a scientific fact is simply a social construction or belief that scientists are able to persuade their colleagues to share. Not necessarily a real thing out there. No wonder kids still leave school, and not just faith schools, believing evolution is a theory like religion. Social justice warriors in training are taught that science is bad because it has led to pollution. Due to a long-term teacher absence, I had to take on some teaching responsibility for sociology A-level this year in my North London comp, having never studied sociology before. My students are mostly young Muslim women who, after 2 decades of ethnic pigeonholing by monitoring forms, do not describe themselves as British, but their personalities are unmistakably those of local North Londoners. As a middle-aged white man, I was obligated to teach these thoughtful and funny and hijab-wearing teenagers that an academic body of knowledge has determined that their modest clothing culture repressed them, and that standing at the back in mosques was evidence of demeaning patriarchal segregation. But you've got to be at the back for prayers, 'cause men like bums, innit? Was the infinitely more worldly reply. Not only is sociology content weak, it is also method poor. Take the lazy quantifier, often 20 to 40% from the quote at the beginning. A mathematically meaningless figure which approaches parody. As Ron Burgundy might put it, more than 50% of the time, Latin American men are drunken whoremongers 20 to 40% of the time. This statement forms part of a phenomenon dubbed the Pentecostalist gender paradox. Viz., why is Pentecostalism, a patriarchal religion, so popular among Latino women, when they ought to be liberating themselves from patriarchal oppression in the, quote, Western style? Answer? Because the poor, obedient women hope the Christian patriarchy will reform their wayward husbands' morals for the better. Maybe they haven't been following the Catholic news for the past 400 years. A teenager with a passion for understanding society is a precious thing. Young people are powerfully engaged in trying to understand and improve their surroundings during the short developmental window between growing out of their homes and becoming invested in the status quo. Yet their reward for showing an interest in society at an early age is to be exposed to tendentious, speculative generalisations, poor methodology, and flagrant falsehoods. Most damning of all is the verdict from universities. You don't need a sociology A-level to take a sociology degree. The same goes for psychology A-level, a subject often chosen by curious and empathic young people who want to know more about themselves and help others. And since the dramatic increase of mental health diagnoses in the young, largely connected to the explosion in childhood smartphone use, a much more urgent problem, psychology has become the country's second most popular A-level after maths. And like sociology, bizarrely, it also exists as a GCSE for 14 to 16-year-olds. Yet a psychologist who's studied literature, sciences, or history, or who has spent time abroad learning a language when they had the chance, has more to offer than one who has studied school psychology instead. Some subjects are suitable only when students have broader knowledge and are capable of understanding nuance and tolerating ambiguity. Art history falls into the same category. These subjects belong at degree level, but not at school. Sociology is not even the least useful A-level. Communications, business, media and TV, and management and administration are also astonishingly popular. There is an important role for the new T-levels here, replacing BTECs, vocational subjects for students to get onto functional training courses and join the workforce quicker. These could be expanded and the outcomes supported, showing that as a society we respect work and not just academia, giving more pupils the opportunity to start their careers earlier and earn a living, rather than be encouraged back into the classroom beyond 16 to spend time and energy on pseudo-academic subjects that will not benefit anyone. At root, it's about economics. Schools make money per pupil, and they attract pupils by offering popular courses. They use exam boards, which both produce and validate the syllabi. Their role is comparable to that of the credit rating agencies in the mortgage crisis of 2008. It is in the exam board's interests to validate the most popular subjects, however unsuitable or weak they are. Like investment managers, the schools earn more from passing on these validated tranches of study to the consumer, namely the child. Schools and exam boards would earn the most from offering curricula in social media and online gaming, and no doubt they soon will. schools must be clear with their students. If they're passionate about a certain subject and want to study it for their degree, but universities don't require the A-level for that subject, then they would do best to stick with the classic core subjects: literature, history, arts, languages, maths, and the sciences.
That was Robert Addis. Now, Lucasta Miller.
Christopher Isherwood pioneered what's now known as autofiction, long before it acquired that label. His best-known work, Goodbye to Berlin, 1939, which later inspired the musical Cabaret, was based on the diaries he kept while living in the Weimar Republic in his 20s. He'd already used that material before in Mr. Norris Changes Trains, a brilliant black comedy thriller that deserves to be read alongside more supposedly serious works of modernism. 40 years later, he reworked the experiences yet again in Christopher and His Kind, 1977. Here, he finally made explicit, for the new gay liberation era, what had been suppressed in the earlier works: his homosexuality, which had previously been outlawed. Although Isherwood emigrated to America in early 1939 and spent the second half of his life in California, he could never quite say goodbye to Berlin. Nor could he give up exploring the ambiguous boundaries between memoir and fiction, a habit that was inculcated early. Born in 1904 into the decaying English gentry, he was already composing autofiction aged six, dictating his first work, The History of My Friends, to his mother, herself an inveterate diarist. Although he so identified with his mother in childhood that he dressed up in her clothes, he later experienced her as a suffocating presence who needed to be ejected, along with the entire English establishment. But he would carry on in the same literary vein throughout his long and prolific career, transforming his personal acquaintance into characters in book after book, from his literary confreres W. H. Auden and Stephen Spender in Lions and Shadows, 1938, to his own parents in Kathleen and Frank, 1971. Most famously, he transformed Jean Ross, the rebellious young upper-middle-class English woman he befriended in Berlin, into the subsequently iconic Sally Bowles, although his version has none of the slick glamour of Liza Minnelli in the 1972 film. Ross's daughter later complained that her mother had been unfairly caricatured. The real Ross, who later became a war correspondent and a lifelong committed communist, had more gumption. She was also enough of a mover and shaker to secure Isherwood his first screenwriting gig, an experience he went on to cannibalise to brilliant effect in his 1945 autobiographical novel Prater Violet. Unlike Minnelli, the Sally Bowles of Goodbye to Berlin is not choreographed into hyper-professionalism by Ken Fossey. Her nightclub performance is embarrassingly amateurish, its unsettling charisma deriving instead from her desperado disinhibition. She's a contradictory character, a combination of naivety and bravado, of self-deception and vulnerable verve, of entitlement and disempowerment, of alienation, attitude and authenticity. Isherwood may not give a full and fair account of Ross, but he uses the character to tell us more about the fatalistic atmosphere in Weimar that Hitler exploited, about class and sex, and also, perhaps, about himself. Goodbye to Berlin's most famous line, "I am a camera," has Isherwood adopting a pose of passive detachment. But it's worth remembering that he went on to extend the photographic metaphor to acknowledge the imaginative shaping and selection that went into his seemingly objective reportage. "Someday all this will have to be developed, carefully printed, fixed," he wrote. As Catherine Bucknell suggests in This New Life, his alterations get closer to the truth than mere documentation ever could. In the early Berlin stories, the personal suppressions and hidden ironies involved seem, in fact, to provide an undertow of created tension that ultimately adds to, rather than detracts from, their superb quality as works of literature. Curiously, Isherwood later couched the supposedly more open confessionalism of Christopher and his kind in the third person, creating an odd sense of dislocation by referring to himself as Christopher rather than I throughout. Perhaps his auto-fictive mode was always driven by a complicated, ironised sense of his own self as simultaneous observer and observed. Backstage, in real life, the experience may have been more messy and painful than the consummate control of his best prose suggests. It was, perhaps, the yogic emphasis on the disillusion of the ego that led him to convert to Hindu mysticism under the guidance of a celebrated Swami shortly after arriving in California. Cabaret audiences might be surprised to hear that his translation of the Vedas remains one of his best sellers, though he balked at becoming a monk due to the celibacy requirement. In California, he also met Don Bacardi, who became his life's partner, despite their eye-popping age difference of 30 years. He had scoffed at Benjamin Britten and Peter Piers for their seemingly bourgeois marriage, but he ended up, despite periods of angst and infidelity, in a relationship of long-term domestic intimacy that eventually saw the two become a celebrated gay couple, subject of a dual portrait by their friend David Hockney. It's perhaps a testimony to their bond that Bacardi never became a character in his partner's work. The fact that Isherwood was so often his own autobiographer makes him a problematic subject for biography. As the editor of his voluminous diaries, Bucknell has devoted her career to his memory. Complementing Peter Parker's excellent 2004 life, this empathetic, exhaustively documented account is also testimony to the author's friendship with Bacardi, now 90. Running to more than 800 pages, it offers a level of immersive detail that is out of sync with the current trend for pithier lives. Though the minutiae are often intriguing. Who knew, for example, that circumcision was a requirement for entry into the combined cadet force at Repton in around 1918? A painful operation to have in adolescence, described by Isherwood's doting mother as the event. This book will be of value to scholars for years to come. It also reminds us of Isherwood's genius in crystallising what he called his shapeless blob of potential material into art.
That was Lucaster Miller. Next, Sam MacPhail.
4 years ago, Madrid didn't exist. Today, the faux Spanish lager is sold in a quarter of British pubs, which makes it one of the fastest growing beers of all time. Madrí is the historic name for Madrid, which is peculiar for a beer brewed in Tadcaster, or Tada, as the Anglo-Saxon mead drinkers would have called it. Madrí has never been brewed in Spain, let alone Madrid, yet it shares the same sanguine red label of real Spanish lagers such as Estrella Galicia, Mal, and Estrella Damm, which allows it to blend in with them on the pub bars and supermarket shelves. People think they are drinking a Spanish beer, but it's not, says Aitor de Artaza, international head of Estrella Galicia. He accuses Madrí of lacking transparency. It's not an unfair criticism. Madrí's owners, the Canadian-American brewing giant Molson Coors, claim Spanish heritage from the tiny Toledo-based brewery they own, which gave Madrí its inspiration. That's it. No recipe, malt or hops. Madrí isn't the first premium lager to have captured a large audience of drinkers very quickly. Peroni did the same here, 2 decades ago, even though it's a fairly bog-standard beer, albeit actually brewed in Italy, and served in a comically tall glass. Part of the appeal of European premium lagers is that they are stronger than standards. Madrí is 4.6% ABV and Peroni 5%, whereas Carling and Coors are about 4%. In truth, all Madrí has going for it is that it's the latest thing. Stella is crisper, Foster's is smoother and Amstel is more rounded. Their drinkers, however, are often unfairly cast as grubby pipemen or yobbish youths. Madrí hasn't been around long enough to pick up such negative social stereotypes. This makes it perfect for the main cohort of lager drinkers, young blokes. Many identify with the beer's mascot, known as Madryman, who's plastered on every can, bottle and tap lens. Madryman is an amalgamation of the modern lad, hipster beard, Gareth Southgate-style waistcoat and Peaky Blinders flat cap. Up for a pint, or ten. The marketing men at Molson Coors insist Madryman is a Spanish culture figure, a chulapo, who was a dapper dancer in Old Madrid. They're fooling no one. Madryman has one main rival, Mr. Moretti. Birra Moretti is Britain's most popular premium lager. Its mascot is a slightly slovenly fellow in an old green suit, based on a patron of a sleeper trattoria in Udine from the 1940s. Moretti sells twice as much as Madry, but Madry has it in its sights. Its sales increased threefold last year. How could Madry lose to such a foe? Madryman is the modern lad. Mr. Moretti is an old boozer who probably supported Il Duce. However, Madry already faces a new competitor called Cruzcampo, which was introduced on draft in April and has sold 42 million pints since. Cruzcampo is owned by Heineken and brewed in Manchester, but unlike Madry, it's also been brewed in Spain for 120 years. Heineken has spent £10 million advertising Cruzcampo's pedigree. Even if you don't come from Seville, you can choose to live the Sevillian way. It's a clear dig at Madry's dodgy credentials. Estrella Galicia has joined the Inquisition. Don't fall for fake brews, says its new campaign. Under such pressure, how long does Madry have before punters ask for a pint of Spanish over Spanish?
That was Sam McPhail. Now, Toby Young.
When I told an editor of this magazine that I was planning to write about why I'm voting for reform, he didn't react as I expected. For God's sake, don't write another of those more in sorrow than in anger pieces, he said. Make it a furious tub-thumping endorsement of Nigel and his gang. I should say at once that this wasn't Boris Johnson, although he does want Nigel Farage to win in Clacton, apparently. Why? Because if Nigel becomes an MP, it will make his takeover of the Tories a more realistic prospect. That way, Boris can re-enter the House of Commons at the earliest opportunity and say to what remains of the parliamentary party, "The only way to stop Nigel is to back me. If anyone else is up against him when the final two are put before the membership, he'll win." That isn't my rationale for voting reform. I live in Acton, not Clacton, but it is equally calculating. In my constituency, the sitting Labour MP has a majority of 13,000, and it's likely to go up, not down. So putting an X against the Tory candidate is a wasted vote. The Reform candidate has even less chance of winning, obviously, but the more votes Reform gets across the country, the stronger will be the case to replace Rishi Sunak with a right-wing firebrand. Like many Conservatives, I've abandoned all hope of winning this election and turned my mind to who's going to be the next leader. The Wets, the people responsible for the coming debacle, in my view, will point to the 2019 Tory voters who've abandoned the party for Labour, the Lib Dems and the Greens, God help us, and argue that the only way back is to elect a centrist dad like Tom Tugendhat. To counter this argument, my lot will need at least as many people who voted Tory last time to plump for reform. Forget all those wishy-washy listeners to The Rest Is Politics, we'll say. It's the working-class voters who feel betrayed that we need to win back. And it's a pretty close-run thing. According to the latest analysis by JL Partners, 20% of those who voted Conservative in 2019 have defected to reform, while 20% are planning to vote for other parties, 15% for Labour, 3% for the Lib Dems, and 2% for the Greens. In other words, each side in the forthcoming bun fight can point to the same number of defectors in both directions. For me, this is the real battleground in this election, and it's so close that every vote counts. I'm not voting for the next Prime Minister, I'm thinking about the next leader of the opposition. I have other, less Machiavellian reasons for backing reform. Whether on bringing net immigration down to zero or ditching carbon emission targets, I'm more closely aligned with its policies than I am with those of the Conservatives. When it comes to the war on woke, Farage really means it, whereas Rishi is all talk and no pedal pushers. The Prime Minister is quintessentially a citizen of anywhere with no strong emotional attachment to this country. Farage, by contrast, whatever else you might think of him, is a genuine patriot. Which isn't to say I'd like him to be the next leader of the Conservative Party. The problem is, even though he'd win back all those 2019 Tories who've defected to reform, he would struggle to coax the deserters on the party's left flank back into the fold. I want a right-wing leader, but one capable of leading the party to victory in 2029, and that means keeping all the 2019 voters on side, not just the pro-Brexit red wallers. So my first choice is Kemi Badenoch, although I do worry that if Nigel wins a seat at the eighth time of trying and is allowed back into the party, he will be the right's preferred candidate, not her. This is presumably why she said last week she wouldn't let him back in. I remember something like the same argument being made to me by Grant Shapps at the Tory Party conference in 2014. I was promoting the idea of a UKIP-Con electoral pact at the time, and David Cameron was sufficiently alarmed by it to ask Shapps, then the party chairman, to have a word. The difficulty with my proposal, he said, was that the Conservatives would end up losing more seats to Labour and the Lib Dems, as a result of getting into bed with Farage, than they'd gain, even if you added any UKIP wins to the total. Does the same argument apply today, given that Nigel has gone to some lengths to detoxify himself? That's a question for the pollsters, but I suspect the answer is yes. In this election, however, he gets my vote.
That was Toby Young. And finally, Catriona Olding.
The other week, my eldest daughter and I were staying with friends in Richmond for the launch of Jeremy's third collection of low-life columns. The night before the anniversary of his death, the day of the launch, I woke at 2 a.m. and, unable to sleep, was back in the cave holding Jeremy's hand, machines clicking and beeping as his life ebbed unpeacefully away. He died at 9 a.m. At 9:05 a.m, in tears and still wearing an IT jumper and flip-flops, I ran downstairs, almost colliding with one of our hosts, out the back door to the bottom of the garden. Beyond the high wooden fence and gate, a path ran parallel with the Thames. I reached up to open the latch. The Thames is quiet there, a great oily mass drifting towards Southend-on-Sea, where Jeremy was born. I stood on the path watching it until in the distance a man came jogging towards me. The book launch passed in a blur. I hardly spoke to anyone, and because I'd had so little sleep, a few drinks and was anxious, the people I did talk to would have been justified in doubting my sanity or thinking I was on drugs. But I did just about manage to hold it together adequately and speak to the company as a whole. I told them this. A few weeks after Jeremy died, I dreamt he walked into the house. He looked fit, strong and full of life. I was overjoyed and said, "How did you get here?" And he just grinned in that cheeky way he did and said, "What day is it, train?" "It's Monday, column deadline day." "Oh, fuck, what am I going to write about?" "Darling, you died 3 weeks ago and here you are, back, at least one column." We're all desperate to know. I'd like to say we embrace, but a dream will only take us so far. After the thrill of London, I spent 10 days between Oxfordshire and Glasgow with my three daughters and two granddaughters. Towards the end of the second week, I took a break from belly crawling across the living room floor with the eldest toddler, pretending to be crocodiles sneaking up on Mummy, to have a night away with school friends. We've known each other since first year at high school, 48 years. Alison is so beautiful, she's really had to work, but she's suffered ill health on and off for most of her life. 2 years ago, we thought we were losing her when she reacted badly to a stem cell transplant. This was around the time my middle daughter had a delayed, because of COVID, diagnosis of thyroid cancer, and Jeremy's prostate cancer became terminal. We chose a night at nearby Mar Hall on the banks of the Clyde at Erskine. Alison has been unable to travel much further. Built in the 1840s for Lord Blantyre, in 1916, the manor house became the Erskine Hospital for limbless sailors and soldiers. I'd been there before. Around 1966, my father, a pituitary giant who was 7 feet 4.5 inches tall, lost the use of his legs and became mostly confined to a wheelchair. My mother went out to work, and Dad, by then in his early 50s, looked after me while I, aged 3, became his legs. Supervised by Bess, our elderly white boxer dog, I'd climb up onto the kitchen cupboards to boil a kettle and make Dad cups of sugary Nescafe
or run errands around the farmhouse. There were no carers. I remember helping him lift his great crippled legs and feet into a basin, flakes of skin and soap scum floating in tepid water. One of the old soldiers from Erskine Hospital made my father's shoes. Despite being disabled and almost blind, Dad still drove his adapted Armstrong Siddeley, with me bouncing around untethered on the front seat beside him. My nerve-wracking job was to look out for traffic and shout "all clear" at the main T-junction into the village. The only time I can remember him shouting at me was once when I got it wrong. The Elizabethan Revival entrance hall to the manor was the recreation room. Men with missing legs or only half a face stopped their chess, cribbage or snooker to stare at us through the fog of 1960s cigarette smoke. I could hardly bear to look up. Dad, with his great height and acromegaly, lengthened jaw and exaggerated cheekbones, and me, a small, unattractive, pale ginger girl with an enormous head that sat on tiny shoulders like a television, were an odd sight too. 56 years later, three of us walked into the same hall. The sadness of the place is all but gone, but there's still something, a lingering fetch perhaps. Over a glass of champagne and later dinner, we covered the usual ground. Teachers, ex-boyfriends, husbands, work, sex, books, children, bereavement and politics. We argued comically with Daniel, the restaurant manager, about the lack of a reasonably priced white burgundy. Puy Fumé isn't burgundy. Aye, but it's a dry white wine. We know, but we don't like Sauvignon. Turned out Daniel was right, and we enjoyed the wine. The food was good enough and the rooms comfortable. After 10 hours of talking and laughing, Alison, like me, a social smoker, was, for the first time since her transplant, feeling sufficiently well to ask if I had any cigarettes. Joy.
And that was Catriona Olding. Before we go, we'd like to take the opportunity to mention that The Spectator will be hosting a special live edition of Coffeehouse Shots in the aftermath of the election. Taking place on Thursday the 11th of July at 7 p.m. here in Westminster, you can join our editor Fraser Nelson, Katie Balls and Kate Andrews as they dissect the election results, a new government and what comes next. Tickets are £35 or £25 for subscribers, and if you're interested, you can book online at spectator.co.uk/shotslive. And that's everything for this week. If you enjoyed those articles, why not pick up a copy of The Spectator magazine to read them and many more in full. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.